Hello, I'm Christopher Lopez, and this is the StarCraft Observer, the show centered around the real-time strategy game StarCraft and its real stories from the community. We talk to artists, streamers, players, creators about their first encounter with the game and how it's changed their lives. Hi, everyone. Sorry for the delay. Things got derailed for me once again. Life these days is getting really unpredictable, but I think we're getting back to a stable spot and landing monthly releases once again. It's crazy. You just never know what tomorrow will bring, no matter where you go and where you are. I never believed it at first, but it really is like a never-ending roller coaster ride with the ups, downs, loops, and eventually the steadiness. Hopefully. I feel like I'm there now, but who knows what'll happen. Last year, I thought I'd reach that moment when I found myself in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia of all places to be exact, and attending a StarCraft tournament by the name of Cheesadelphia. I'm not too far from Philly myself, it's about a 2-hour drive, and having never been there, I thought why not take a little road trip to an esports event that I'd been wanting to go to for a while. It was such an incredible experience. I made some new friends and met today's guest there too, whom at the event was one of the nicest, welcoming, and knowledgeable folks that I've ever met from the community. We talked a bit about StarCraft, of course, projects we're working on, aspirations, and gave each other advice on how to interview, properly get in touch with folks, and other various content ideas. After the event was over, which lasted one weekend, we all went our separate ways back to normal life, but still filled with excitement because just on the horizon, the biggest tournament for the NA region would be starting. DreamHack Atlanta. Why was it so exciting? Well, one reason was that it would be the first time in years that StarCraft would not be featured at BlizzCon, so DreamHack Atlanta made up for that. The second reason was the current state of things at the time. The Electronic Sports League, or ESL for short, had just outlined the plan for the year of 2022, but gave no updates the following year of 2023. Everyone at the time thought, could this possibly be the last major event for StarCraft 2? So of course, I packed my bags, hopped in a van, drove 10 hours, which I'll never do again, and made it to Atlanta, Georgia. And let me tell you, lots of folks were in attendance for day one. More people on day two, and even more people on day three, to the point where seats had to be brought out, which eventually they ran out of. And at one point, there was a couch from the green room next to the massive crowd. And during my time there, I would once again run into today's guest, and this time, we did a brief interview in which we filmed in the lobby.
Okay. All right, so we're here with Nish, the StarCraft Observer. Hello. On TikTok, on Instagram. So what's going on? We just got out of the finals. How was that?
And that other voice that you heard asking all the questions is the StarCraft historian, also known to me as Ahmed. It was also great to see and hear that someone else is on the pursuit of creating StarCraft-related content that's documenting things here and there. So we sit down with the historian and get to know him a little bit more.
I grew up in Staten Island, New York. It was pretty cool, man. I really appreciated the proximity to Manhattan and Brooklyn while being able to still have like the, you know, suburban life and with a yard and stuff like that. I think there were some things about Staten Island that I wasn't really cognizant of, like how politically conservative it is and stuff like that until I got older. But when I was a kid, I was kind of just enjoying it for what it was.
Was anything like weird to you growing up? I guess that political climate, did anything like stand out to you as a kid?
Oh, for sure. So I'm half Pakistani and half Italian, but because most of my Pakistani family lives in Pakistan and most of my Italian family lives here, I was obviously exposed to them a lot more. So I think in my mind, I identified a lot more culturally with like the white part of my family. And so I didn't really view myself as different, but looking back on it, I understand why a lot of people kind of maybe viewed me or treated me a little differently. Just after 9/11, it got really weird because there was obviously a lot of animosity towards Muslims, Middle Easterners, but like, you know, the average bigot doesn't understand the difference between a South Asian person and a Middle Easterner or Saudi or whatever. So I have like one distinct memory of like being at the park, and like that park has like a beach, so usually we like walk around there, that sort of thing. But it was kind of just like a pretty typical thing. I would say as a family, we would go to the park and stuff maybe like, you know, once a month, once every other month, that sort of thing. And that was sort of like our regular park. And like some random dude just like pegged my dad in the head with a football, just like randomly. And it was like, really scary. You know, it was kind of like the first time I think I ever really experienced or really like understood that, like, oh, this is like a prejudice thing. Like, he was targeted. So it was weird to feel kind of alienated in somewhere I'd previously felt so comfortable.
Wow. So, like, did you hear them say anything before they threw the ball, or?
Yeah, like laughing and sort of like, you know, like murmuring. I think we weren't really paying attention, you know, because it was just like, it was obviously normal for them to be playing catch in the park. And, you know, what made it obvious that it was sort of vindictive is they didn't apologize. And so it was like, oh, okay, well, it was obviously on purpose because they're not sorry.
Yeah, yeah. And what'd your dad say about it?
Nothing. He's not a very confrontational person. He's just, yeah, he's the kind of person to really, like, it takes a lot to get him real angry. So he definitely something you would just walk away from.
And did he tell you anything after the events that transpired?
No, it was more so my sister. I could tell that she was emotional, like, when we went home. And I didn't, because she's like 7 years older than me, so obviously she understood it to a much deeper level. But yeah, I can't say I remember specifics, but I do just remember her explaining that, you know, it was deliberate and it was because of our heritage, which was really confusing to me.
Ahmed would describe to me that his living on Staten Island was like being a fly in milk, and mentioned that he would get the occasional strange looks from folks around him because of his Pakistani descent. Though 9/11 was a difficult time for he and his family, they were getting along just fine, because outside of school and being a suburban kid, Ahmed would occasionally help his dad at the corner store he owned in New York City.
He has some commercial property, but his day-to-day was operating like a restaurant, like a fried chicken and pizza place. So I spent a lot of my youth there, working there, and also just experiencing a super different like neighborhood, because like I grew up in a, you know, not like posh neighborhood, but like low crime and you know, pretty nice. And the area where his businesses were super high crime and very low income.
Two different worlds, essentially. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so, like, I remember seeing my dad get, like, stabbed in the face when I was a kid.
Wait, your dad got stabbed in the face?
He got stabbed in the face, stabbed in the back, held up at gunpoint on different occasions, all those, yeah.
And you saw this?
I only saw him get stabbed in the face. The held up at gunpoint and stabbed in the back thing were kind of like years prior. But yeah, when I was like maybe like 11, I was working with him and it was kind of late at night. And so the entrance was from the sort of catty corner direction. And then the counter was facing that direction. And then there was like a customer area, like, you know, between the door and the counter. And then there was like a gate on the side, like a big iron gate. And I used to look through that door. We used to leave the door open a lot and with the gate closed to like for airflow. I do remember I was looking out the gate when the first confrontation happened. And then the guy came back in like screaming and yelling or whatever. And then like my dad and his employees were basically telling him to get the hell out of there. And then like a couple hours later, that guy came back and he had sharpened an umbrella. So we actually had like bulletproof glass and like a window that opened and closed like to exchange the money. And so, yeah, he basically waited for him to open the window and then he lunged in and stabbed him with a sharpened umbrella.
Wait, sharpened like the tip of like the metal part, like sharpened?
Yep. And also this thing missed his eye by like maybe an inch.
Oh, my God. Wow.
And so, yeah, it was just like the top of his cheek was just like torn open and he was bleeding and I was freaking out. But he was just trying to calm me. So he literally was just like speaking to me gently and smiling and just like making sure that I didn't get too scared. At first it was panic, but then I started crying because I was like concerned about him and scared. I had seen a lot of crime in the neighborhood, but it was the first time I had seen any violence done to somebody I knew.
As he's like talking to you and like trying to console you, is he like bleeding out of his face like crazy or?
Yeah, like streaming down his face. He's taking like paper napkins and just holding them to his face to sop it up. And then like, you know, we called 911 and whatever. And the EMTs just like, I don't even know if he needed stitches. I'm pretty sure they just put like a big bandage on it. But yeah, yeah. And then the cops did find that guy and I'm pretty sure he got arrested. The thing is ultimately, you know, it's not something you go away like forever for. But the thing is, a lot of times in these scenarios, it's like, it's just some guy being high or drunk and getting crazy with it in that moment. You know what I mean?
His dad is definitely one tough dude. During that time, between helping out his dad and being a suburban kid, his uncle would eventually introduce him into video games.
When I was really little, maybe still like a toddler, my dad's cousin lived with us for a little while, and he was pretty into technology and stuff, and he introduced me and my sister to Age of Empires 2. And I got really into playing like sandbox games and like battle simulations. I was really, really into history, you know, just like historical warfare and things like that. So being able to play out like fictional battles was awesome. And then I also played a lot of Age of Mythology, which is obviously another real-time game.
So how exactly did our little historian encounter StarCraft then?
It's actually really funny. So I remember my friend was like, hey man, there's this game called StarCraft, and I think it's pretty cool. And it's the national sport of South Korea. And I was like, dude, you're dumb. Like, you read something online that's clearly not true and you believed it. And then he pulled up this CNN article that said, like, South Korea's de facto national sport is a video game. And then we ended up, like, watching a bunch of Brood War, like, random videos and stuff. And I think the original, like, Wings of Liberty came with, like, 4 of those battle passes that gave you, like, a month of free access or something like that. Or maybe it was even a week, I don't remember. Like, it was, like, basically keys you could redeem and you could playtest. Or, like, you know, you could basically play Wings of Liberty for a little while and then it would expire. And he gave me all of them in succession. And so he had the game for like a few months before I got it. And then I remember I played it for like a week. I was like, this game is stupid. It doesn't make any sense.
Wait. You thought it was stupid because you couldn't win at the game, or like what?
I just felt like I couldn't do anything. I feel like no matter what I did, no matter what kind of like strategy I drummed up, and like I just got killed. and so I was like, all right, well, I don't know how to get better at this. I also got stuck, and I ended up staying stuck in this mindset for like a really embarrassingly long period of time, like maybe a month and a half or something, where in my brain I was like, no, I'm gonna wall in with cannons on 2 bases, and that's enough resources. 2 bases enough, and as long as I take my time, I'm gonna max out on void rays, and then I'm gonna kill them. And I remember, obviously, what he started doing was just nidusing into my main with roaches and killing me. Or he would just take like 10 bases and then just throw infinity corruptors at my void rays.
Right. Cause you're just like busy, like turtling and just trying to build everything up on 2 bases. And you know, they knew that. So like, yeah, I'm going to take advantage of this and just take every base again.
Exactly.
Finally finding his passion about a certain game and something that had him emotionally attached, Ahmed was deep into the world of StarCraft and watching anything and everything he can. One specific person that we know and love was a huge influence on him.
I got exposed to Day9, and that like completely turned around my perspective. I was like, this game's still stupid, but this guy's pretty cool. And I remember, like, specifically, I mean, like for many, many other people, it was the Day9 Daily 100, right? So it wasn't even necessarily the content about the game. It was more so his emotional attachment to the game. I think it was like nothing I had ever seen or heard. I didn't know you could be that emotionally invested in a game, and I found it fascinating. And then I just started consuming all of his the daily content about SE2, and the rest is kind of history. It still took me forever to start beating my friend, but I did eventually stop turtling on 2 bases.
And it wasn't just Day9 that had Ahmed attached to this game. Someone else in his life had the same passion for gaming and would become a spectator along his side. Who that person is, coming up after the break. Hi everyone. If you're enjoying the podcast so far and would like to keep up with StarCraft Observer, follow us on TikTok, Instagram, and Twitter, where not only will you get updates about the latest episodes, but some original content when it comes to the podcast and StarCraft-related gripes. Once again, follow us on TikTok, Instagram, and Twitter. Want to support today's guest? Enjoy someone who travels the world and interviews people from the StarCraft community? Well, here's how you can support the StarCraft Historian. Head on over to their YouTube, search for the StarCraft Historian, and subscribe to their channel. They're also on Twitter, in which you can follow at SC2 Historian. That's at SC2 Historian, one word. Links to their channel can be found in today's podcast show notes. Welcome back. So we last left off with the StarCraft historian finally encountering StarCraft and how he couldn't believe that it was a national sport in Korea. That would soon lead him down the StarCraft rabbit hole, where he would eventually watch and learn all things StarCraft, and soon discover Sean Plott, also known as Day9. But along the way, there would be someone far more important who was very close to him, and also had a passion for gaming. That person? Ahmed's mom.
Like, she was super into, like, arcade games when she was younger, and then as she got older, she was an early adopter of video games. She bought the NES, Nintendo Entertainment System, in, like, the late 80s, and she had a huge game selection and all the accessories, and she got really, really into all the Super Mario worlds, Yoshi's Island, Castlevania, and she became, like, by modern standards, we would call a speedrunner. Like, she would just memorize maps, and, like, she would memorize the order of events in Zelda, and then she would, like, skip multiple levels because she figured out that she could, you know, glitch through this one spot, or X part of the game wasn't pivotal, which was a really different way of thinking about games, I think, that early on. She used to keep the game consoles, at least those really early game consoles, in her bedroom. And that's the funny thing, right? Like, it was actually just, like, hers. And we used it as well, but I think it's very counterintuitive relative to most people's experience. Yeah, I remember spending, like, late nights sometimes just, like, laying in bed with her and specifically eating Fig Newtons. That was our late night snack. And just watching her play Zelda and just watching her play Mario.
Like, what was your favorite console game? Was it Zelda or?
Yeah, definitely Zelda. Like, Zelda and Mario for sure, like the original Super Mario World. But I think overall as a series, it was probably the Zelda series, because she played every Zelda up until the N64. She didn't like 3D games. She never played. The only 3D game I remember her liking was Crash Bandicoot on the PlayStation. I also got her to watch all kinds of, like, StarCraft, like, hype videos and, like, videos of people, like, you know, she watched the entirety of the Day9 Daily 100 with me, like, you know, after I had already watched it probably 10 times. But for her, like, she enjoyed sports, she enjoyed observing competition in general, like, competitions of all sorts. She, like, watched, like, she would watch the Olympics, she would watch baking competitions, she would watch a lot of baseball. And so I think she could definitely respect that part of it.
When she watched the Day9 Daily 100, did she get emotional too, or?
Oh yeah, 1000%. I remember her crying during the part where Sean talks about eliminating Tasteless from the 2005 WCG USA Nationals, and just, you know, him explaining how upset Nick was, but simultaneously how happy for and proud of his brother he was. My mom had a really good relationship with her siblings as well, so I think she was, you know, definitely able to empathize with that.
Hearing that our young StarCraft historian introduces mom to one of the biggest pieces of StarCraft history, and most importantly, even enjoyed the Day9 Daily number 100, is a pretty big deal. Not everyone can say they watch StarCraft content with their mom, which back then was not the coolest thing to say, but when you're older, it's one of the coolest things ever. And he definitely has one of the coolest moms ever.
So she would hear me, like, getting up and getting ready, and then, you know, I would like to watch the matches with a bit of volume. So she would usually, yeah, if it was like 5 a.m. or so, she would usually just come hang out with me and just, like, yeah, we would chit chat between the matches, and she would cheer on, you know, the Koreans that I really liked. I remember when Jaedong went back to Korea, she was like, I was telling her about it, and she was super excited, even though he never really ended up doing anything. But
right.
it was a weird part of our relationship, but definitely one I treasure looking back on it. It was super cool to be able to explain why I was passionate about this fairly socially unacceptable thing, but to have her get it and understand why I was excited was pretty cool.
But there was a reason as to why Ahmed's mom would wake up so early to watch the matches with him and watch his favorite players.
She got diagnosed with cancer when I was, like, I want to say maybe 15. And because of that, she ended up staying up all night, or really barely sleeping at times.
How did you go about, like, processing that?
I mean, at first I was very optimistic. You know, I felt like she was a young, healthy person, and young, healthy people don't get sick and die. You know, that's kind of like the perspective that you have. And her first doctor was actually a real piece of crap and basically just told her that there was no hope and that she was going to be dead in 6 months. Even if that was true, he just had no bedside manner. You know, he scared the crap out of her and really sucked all the hope out of her. But my sister, my third oldest sister, anyway, she wanted to be a doctor for ages, and she was a very motivated person. So she ended up not accepting that answer and doing a lot of legwork and getting her admitted to some clinical trials and stuff like that. And we wanted her to go to Sloan Kettering, which is like, you know, whatever, a very famous cancer hospital in New York. But my aunt actually like died there. And not that really meant anything, but it just messed up her mind because like her sister had died there just like a few years earlier. So we ended up going with NYU, and the doctors there were actually awesome.
And at this point in our conversation, I'm deeply empathizing with Ahmed because I too recently went through the traumatic experience of their mom being diagnosed with cancer. As much as I hoped that it would stop with my mom, my dad recently was diagnosed with cancer. It's like this. It's like this never-ending turmoil being built up and torn down again, with stress levels being on a different level. For me, my family's halfway across the nation, and phone calls can be pretty lengthy with my sister, mainly because I'm trying to pinpoint the information, the accuracy of that information, and getting upset sometimes that my family didn't ask certain questions at the appointment. What helped was having a support system in place. Friends, family, my then ex-wife, and my now divorce support group that I've been a part of that's helped me vent some frustrations outside of divorce and the events my family is going through. So understanding how difficult it could be, I asked how he dealt with it. So how did you go about dealing with that?
You know, for a while, I think I just didn't. I remember, like, I was really struggling in school, maybe like a year after her diagnosis. And I remember my Chinese teacher, who was kind of known as a pretty cold fish, kind of just like, you know, keeping me after class one day and being like, what's up? And, you know, I didn't really want to talk to her about it because I like, you know, she was fine, but her and I weren't like super cool.
Like, how'd she know?
I was usually a pretty social and like outspoken person. It was also at a time where like, for the first time I had been putting a pretty decent amount of effort into my Chinese, which was like my foreign language class in high school. And then I kind of just stopped, you know, like I went from like a B to a D in like a couple months. I don't think it was necessarily that she noticed like the emotional difference. I think she was kind of just confused as to why I went from like putting an effort to not kind of quickly.
How did she pull you off to the side? Like how did that come about?
It was like an after the class sort of thing. It was like we were about to leave and she was just like, oh, Hamid, can you just like hang out, you know, or rather just like hang with me for a minute? And I was like, yeah, sure. Which was pretty atypical. Like I said, she wasn't like a particularly hip or like she didn't like interact with students that much.
So it was like kind of like weird for you already. Like what, like something's going on. So then she pulls you. She tells you like, hey, can we talk for a minute? And then like, what does she say to you?
She kind of just asked me what was going on, and I was kind of resistant at first. Like, I wasn't really saying anything because it felt weird to reveal something very personal and emotional to her, to somebody that I just wasn't so comfortable with. And I do remember eventually just being honest and telling her that she had cancer. And you know, of course, like, she was pretty taken aback. And I remember saying, like, oh, it's okay. And she was like, no, it's not. It's not okay at all. To see the emotion and stuff on a lady who I viewed as kind of unemotional,
mm-hmm.
I think woke me up to the severity of the situation a little bit. I want to say that she was a little bit softer toward me from there.
Right. That's kind of like a little eye-opener, huh? Like when you're feeling some type of way and you just don't know what's going on. For somebody to tell you, like, you know, what you're feeling is okay and you're allowed to feel that way, it's just like, wait, what? Like, I can?
Yeah, totally.
It's definitely an eye-opener when somebody can see that, especially, like, when they do see it on you, like, when they can physically see that something's going on. It's really weird. It's like somebody's been watching you the whole time and just like monitoring you almost, like passively.
Yeah, if they can notice a change, yeah, you know, it's like, especially from somebody that you think isn't necessarily observing you that closely.
Yeah, exactly. So Ahmed's foreign language teacher would check in from time to time to see how well he was doing, along with his mom. To help him even further cope with everything, after school, he would just hang out with his friends to take his mind off things and forget the stresses of what tomorrow might bring. And for a while, that tomorrow of being cancer-free did come.
My mom ended up being cancer-free for like a bit. I want to say it was during like my senior year. So we kind of got to this point where we thought like that she was going to be fine. So I think the emotional toll went down a lot. And the thing was, though, like I got into Chinese and I ended up applying to Shanghai Dashui, which is, you know, Shanghai University. And I got accepted there, for their, like, they do a program in English for foreigners with like a focus on Chinese. And I got all my ducks in a row and I got my visa and organized my lodging and I was getting ready to move to Shanghai for college. And then I remember my mom just sitting me down one day and just like crying and kind of just like begging me not to go. I remember specifically what she said to me, but like, she started crying and she was like, you're going to go there and you're going to meet a girl and you're going to fall in love. And then she's not going to move back here. So you're just going to stay there and you're going to live in China for the rest of your life.
Oh man.
And I was like, okay, that's quite a leap.
Mm-hmm.
So then I ended up just staying here. My two oldest siblings had moved out already. My brother was living here, but was not very active in the family. He was just very involved in his personal life. And my third oldest sister had actually moved to the Caribbean to go to medical school. So there was a time period where it was just me, my mom, my dad living in my house. And that was really, really weird in and of itself, because we were like a 7 to 8 person household most of my life, or at least until I was like a middle schooler or teenager. And it was a big shift in a lot of ways. Like, we went from a very loud, boisterous household to a really quiet, reserved household. And I remember having just like a lot of quality time with my mom. Like, I was going to college in Brooklyn by that point. So I'll get home really late and my mom would always wait until I got home to have dinner with me. And even when I got home at like 9 or 10 p.m. And yeah, the fact that she still like did a lot of the housework and stuff, even when she was on like chemo, and it was definitely a testament to her resiliency and just a lot of things.
Unfortunately, these happy moments didn't last. His mother's cancer had metastasized to the liver, meaning that it spread from one area of the body and onto her liver. And as Ahmed told me, the liver is a really hard thing to treat when it comes to cancer. During our interview, he described to me the process involved in treating this particular cancer. The doctor would take radiated pellets and put them on top of the small cancerous tumors that had developed over time. This technique prevents the further spread, and for a while it was working. That was until one day.
And I could tell that things were different this time, because when they returned from all their previous things, like, you know, sometimes it was good news and sometimes it was bad news, but it was always centered around that idea of like, okay, well, if it's bad news, that's fine. You know, what do we do next? Or what does she do next? What does the doctor think, you know, is the next, what are we going to try next? I remember having that conversation with my sister where like, it was the same conversation as before. Like, okay, well, the treatment she was on for the last few months isn't working. So like, what's next? And I remember that conversation specifically was between me and my sister and my brother. And yeah, I remember her just saying that there wasn't anything else and that they weren't going to give her any more treatment. And it definitely took me a moment, but I don't think I necessarily like put it together right away, but I could see it on her face, you know, that meant it was the end. My mom at that point was really, really scared. Like, she knew she was going to die, and it was, you know, it was obviously a pretty hard pill to swallow.
In the following days, his mom was feeling defeated. She bounced back for a bit, but Ahmed recalls that after one of his birthday dinners, she was a bit disoriented and began to act weird over the next few days. Like, one moment she'll be talking about her friends to Ahmed, and the next moment she'll be talking about pickles for some reason, quickly going from one topic to the next with no relation to each other, kind of like being in a state of cognitive dissonance, as he mentions during our interview. They began to worry, so they checked in with her doctor, and he began to explain that it was due to the toxins from her treatment that were getting to her brain, which was the cause of her acting weird and out of character. And shortly after, things took a turn.
And things went downhill so fast. It was so weird. I remember, like, we found this out in, like, early July 2015, maybe 16. Yeah, that sounds about right. And to explain, I guess, the rationale. So a couple of years before my mom got diagnosed, my aunt, who was actually her youngest sister, she got cancer and passed away, lung cancer. What happened was, like, she got put into hospice care, and at that point, her body was really, really dilapidated. And so I think we all had these, like, kind of traumatizing images in our brain of, like, seeing her look very, like, almost like skeleton-like in the bed in the hospital. And also just, like, her passing away in a place where, you know, it wasn't her home. It was like a sad, very, you know, cold environment. I mean, at least this is me, like, you know, putting words in my mom's mouth, but I think that was the reason. But ultimately, she was really, really adamant about not wanting to die in a hospital. She wanted to do it at home. And so we did in-home hospice care. We had, like, not a live-in nurse, but there was, like the nurses came in like two 12-hour shifts or two 10-hour shifts or something. And then we had we set up like a hospital bed, like in the living room. And my family is very traditional. So we had like 30, 40 people coming over our house a day, like not at once, cause we don't have like a big giant house or something, but like spread out. I remember I was actually sleeping and I was sleeping actually downstairs. My sister came and woke me up in sort of a frenzy, and she was basically just saying, like, oh, you gotta come up, like, you gotta come up, like, that basically, that's it. And then I just, like, threw on pants and came up, and because I you know, like, I knew what it was. I knew if she was coming to get me in a frenzy, it was because she either had just died or she was going to. So yeah, I just remember seeing her look uncomfortable, and then it sort of just going away, and her face just, you know, became still. And I think the most jarring part of it was, like, watching the funeral home guys, like, take her away. That was definitely the most cathartic experience of it all.
Why so the aftermath?
Seeing, like, no matter how gently they do it, they're gonna, like, handle her like an inanimate object. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I think, what went through my mind was like, oh, like, you know, they're carrying her out like they would a fragile piece of furniture, you know, like it's not a person anymore.
And during all that time, Ahmed's dad was by her side. Towards the end, he mentions that his dad and his mom grew closer, more affectionate towards each other, held hands more, watched TV together as time went on. The following years would be a turbulent time for Ahmed. He would go on to move to upstate New York to attend university at Albany, or UAlbany, or SUNY Albany, what have you, where he would study informatics. And because it was such an emotionally difficult time for him, he would have to drop out of college. He would eventually find a steady full-time job, and would develop a proper support system to get him through it all, which he states kept him afloat barely. But as we know, there'd be one saving grace. The one thing that would have him meeting even more people and traveling the world. When did the whole StarCraft historian thing start to happen?
So it's really funny, man. I love the game, and I was always trying to be involved with the game. I remember organizing my friends into like a high school StarCraft team, and we competed against some other high schools and stuff, and we were god awful. We lost so many matches. but I just, like, something in me always wanted to be involved in StarCraft on a deeper level. And I think when I was younger, I felt like, oh, well, you know, I'm too young and I'm not that good at the game, so this is really no path for me here. And then as I got older, I remember thinking like, oh, like, I think I do have some interesting things to say about this game. And I think I do understand this community in a deeper way than most, you know, than the average viewer necessarily. But the scene is dead or it's dying. And there was so much woe. So I thought like, creators are leaving the StarCraft scene, so obviously there's no room for anybody to enter. And it's funny because I think that thought process happened before so many of the people that we love now became big creators, like Pig and Wordy and Loco. And they might have all been making content, you know, obviously for a long time, but not necessarily like super successful with it.
Right.
But then you even see like, you know, Euthermal getting 100,000 subs in a year or whatever he did, like, you know, incredible. And then that's all recent.
What Ahmed says about how he felt that there wasn't any room for content creators because the scene was dying was something I felt too before starting all of this. I don't know where the idea even came from, but it certainly did plague my mind. Probably because of the announcements of WCS, Blizzard's World Championship Series no longer continuing, StarCraft II no longer being at BlizzCon, and all the uncertainty at the time that was looming above our heads. Definitely one of StarCraft's darkest times. But I will say this about content creation in StarCraft II. This is not true. There is and always will be room for creators. The only thing that stands between future StarCraft content creators is fear. The fear of putting out some new type of content and afraid of it not being received very well by the StarCraft community. To be honest, this is the same for every single community out there, and it's a natural feeling for newcomers. But once you put out that thing that you created, it'll find the right audience, and soon you'll find yourself surrounded by those who appreciate the stuff you're creating. You just need to get over that fear and put it out there, or sometimes you just need that catalyst that our StarCraft historian needed to go forth and put their stuff into the world.
Part of it, I think, was the Stormgate announcement. And like, there is going to be like a next step, you know, like making StarCraft content doesn't have to be a dead end if this other game becomes successful. I think that was like the initial motivator, or I should say that was the catalyst. But I think the actual motivator was like the Pylon show stopping was part of it. And just feeling like there was nobody to get the awesome stories that I knew all my favorite players and creators had in them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It just felt like there wasn't a lot of people making that, and I was like, hey, like, I could totally make this, like, I could, yeah, at least try. And then I remember like creating the channel in like October of last year, mm-hmm. but not posting anything. And then I went to Cheesadelphia, and that was sort of just like trying to get my feet wet. I took some pictures and posted them or whatever, and to some positivity. And then and then Atlanta rolled around, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna actually, you know, network with some people ahead of time, and I'm gonna approach or whatever, you know, random people. And obviously you were one of them. I knew you, so that was really nice. And I knew Tempo, Kwame, and then a few other people were really nice, and, you know, did interviews with me. And I got about the type of reception that I expected, you know, a few hundred views here and there, mm-hmm. and people were pretty positive about it, and yeah. I kind of enjoyed it. So I had attended a DreamHack, I had attended a few Cheeses, I had attended the Rebel Battlegrounds, and I had attended GSL in 2019. So the last thing on my bucket list was going to a world championship. Obviously, I always wanted that to be BlizzCon, but obviously, you know, at that point it was Katowice. So I had booked that, and I was like, okay, I think, you know, Katowice is a chance for me to make some content that maybe is bigger than what I was able to do at Atlanta. And as a precursor, I posted that interview with Wax, and that got like a couple thousand views. And that was already like mind blowing to me. I thought 500-600 views would be the absolute ceiling.
And there's where your second motivator comes in, or rather the validation for your content. The viewership, the like count, the retweets, or whatever metric you use. When you get a higher than average viewership count, it's just mind-blowing, as Ahmed mentions. Sure, it's 1,000 views, but that's literally 1,000 people that watched your video. Like, picture a room full of 1,000 people. Just think about it. 1,000 people that picked your content took time out of their day to watch your video. That means a lot to small creators. Ahmed eventually does another interview, and much to his surprise, was really well received.
And I think I maybe posted like a the Fear Dragon video before that or something like that. But I remember posting it while we were traveling, and then I landed in Amsterdam and it had 17,000 views.
Oh my God.
And I was like, I near shit my pants. That was like, I was blown away. Like I literally felt like, holy crap, like you can be successful as a new StarCraft creator.
See, you can become a successful content creator in the StarCraft space. And as I mentioned, you just need to get over the fear. But there's one thing that every content creator needs. A North Star. It's the thing that's eventually achievable, only it's a bit way off. But it's the thing that keeps us going.
Original inception for this StarCraft Historian channel, I was super duper excited about the prospect of Maru winning his G5L, right? In my mind, that was going to be the most significant achievement in the history of the game. And I was like, I can't believe no one's going to make like a documentary about this. And that was like the initial inception. I was like, nah, I want to go to Korea. I want to make a documentary. And I had never done anything like that. and I had no notoriety in the community. And that's basically what everybody told me. Some people told me a little nicer. Some people were a little more blunt. But people basically told me, like, hey, listen, StarCraft is fucking dead. There's no room for new content creators. Nobody knows who you are. So this is not going to happen. And obviously they were right in terms of making a documentary. Like, nobody was going to give me the money to do that as an unknown. But, you know, ultimately I ended up thinking to myself, you know what? I still want to do this. I still want to, you know, make some really cool content in the future. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start by just making some interviews and stuff, and I'm gonna get notoriety that way, and then maybe one day I'll get to make a more significant project. And that's honestly still kind of what I'm working towards. I think my long-term goal for the channel is to make some more artistic and possibly feature-length pieces.
And Ahmed is still working towards that goal of one day making some feature-length pieces, and he's really chasing the dream. I mean, I recently just saw him in the audience of the 2023 GSL Finals while sitting at my home. And in one of his earlier YouTube videos, he spoke with Tim Morton, former lead developer of StarCraft II and now CEO of Frostgiant, the creators of the new up-and-coming RTS, Stormgate. He's doing some incredible things. Like, just check out these interviews.
Yuna, thanks so much for taking the time, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no worries. I think it's always fun to talk about StarCraft and the scene in general.
Do you feel like the greatest player of all time?
I don't know. I don't really feel like much. I just feel like...
Okay, so Loco, thanks so much for taking the time today, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no worries. Happy to do it.
So Cure, thank you so much for taking the time today. I really appreciate it.
제가 영광입니다.
So how'd you first get into StarCraft? Okay, so Tazeless, thanks so much for taking the time today, man.
Thank you for inviting me on, man.
Of course.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, I appreciate your time. So just jumping into things, how'd you first get into StarCraft?
Rainer, thanks so much for taking the time today, man. I really appreciate it.
No worries. I'm excited.
Same, man. I've been hoping to get you on for a while. So Kara, thanks so much for taking the time today. I'm glad we finally got the opportunity to sit down and do this.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I distinctly remember discovering Nick talking to a stranger online, and I dragged him off the computer and said to him, we don't talk to strangers. And he said, okay, please don't stop me. I think he was in middle school. He was like, don't stop me. Like, be calm. I need you to understand this is a Korean pro. And I said, a Korean pro what? And he's like, he's a pro player. He's in Korea. And I'm like, you're talking to strangers in Korea?
It's incredible to see someone's passion taking them from new places and meeting new people. I mean, going to Korea, interviewing Nick Tasteless Plot, Day9's brother, Liquid Cure, Kara LaForge, Day9's mom, Loco, Rainer, Cyril, just a few of the greats from our community. And as I'm watching these YouTube videos, I wondered, what one of his personal great influences would have to say. Like, after all that, like, what do you think your mom would say about, like, the whole entire thing of, like, what you've been doing now? Like, I mean, you guys, like, sat down with each other, like, watching StarCraft and, you know, being genuine fans together. Like, what do you think she would say to the stuff that you're making now?
Yeah, man, that's something I've thought about here and there. It makes me cry every time, dude. I know she would be incredibly proud. I know even if she didn't give a crap about it, she would watch every single video. And yeah, I know that she would just know that it's like, it's just such a big deal for me. Even if I'm not, you know, famous, and even if I'm not making a lot of money or anything, she would know that, like, you know, that wasn't the reason I did it anyway. You know, that wasn't the genesis. It was just because I love the game, and I always love the game, and this is a culmination of, like, 12, 13 years of my life. And yeah, I can't imagine she would be anything but supportive. I'm pretty sure she would have sent my videos to, like, everybody she knew, or especially, like, when I was on the Home Story Cup cast, even if it was just for a little while. Like, that would have, like, being on a live broadcast, I think she would have really went apeshit over that.
Once again, thank you to the StarCraft historian for giving me the time and the opportunity for an interview. I'd also like to thank him for being emotionally raw and upfront when it came down to asking some difficult questions. Thank you so much, Ahmed, for trusting me and telling your story. You can follow StarCraft historian on Twitter and YouTube. You can find additional details in the podcast show notes. Editing, music, and production was done by your host, Christopher Lopez. Outro music by the talented Televangel. Head on over to their Bandcamp or YouTube. You can also find Televangel on Spotify. More details about Televangel in the podcast show notes. Until next time, friends, thank you very much.